Hey, it's the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me is Steve. How are you doing?
Great, John. How are you today?
Just glad I'm not outside. You could swim in the streets today in up here in Northern California. I'm here in San Francisco, and thunderstorms, lightning, hail, frogs, all kinds of apocalyptic things going on.
When did the locusts arrive?
That's the one I forgot. Yes, right. Every kind of swarm. And in a very symbolic sense, it seems like that's coming to the economy. It's all I see is about predictions about recessions, hard times.
It's all just coming all at once, it seems like. Although I've actually heard some news about the being potentially more of a soft landing in the works. So it could be worse, I guess.
Well, that's the goal.
That's a goal. That's a goal.
Yeah. Well, we don't have this a huge debt underwater real estate market that we had in the last time. So apparently loans are better underwritten than they were before.
Awesome. I guess that helps.
But who am I to talk about underwriting when we have an expert in the lending space? We're lucky to have Todd Schwartz, the CEO of OppFi, with us this week. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for welcoming me on your show. Very flattered that you would call me an expert, but I've definitely spent some time in the consumer lending space. So I can definitely give you my take and how I'm seeing things.
Yeah, for sure. Lots of, since we started in with the challenges, what are you guys seeing right now? And what are your expectations in the next few months or so?
Yeah, that's a great question. With the uncertainty and the volatility of interest rates and the Fed having so much power in today's, stock market and just in the economy in general, right? You've seen a very rapid rise in interest rates and went into a technical recession. Now, I got to dust off my econ books from college, but a typical recession is defined by, where the Fed would be lowering interest rates, right? And you would start to see unemployment tick up, right? There would be layoffs and unemployment. Consumer spending, which is 75% of GDP, would be going, would be rapidly, declining. This has been a really hard one to figure out, right? There's aspects of the late 70s in this with very high inflation, 9% sustained inflation, with interest rates doubling overnight. But you have this really phenomenon of very low unemployment. And there's actual wage growth, right, to offset some of this. And so, I think we're in uncharted territories. You can really look back in time, and there really hasn't been a time like this. Obviously, this was exacerbated by COVID, where you stopped the economy essentially for a month and then kind of fired it back up and introduced a lot of stimulus. So, we're all kind of, waiting to see more cards fall and waiting to see what the Fed's going to do. And I think this last year, companies were positioning themselves and trying to, react. It was a very reactionary environment for companies to see how things were going to kind of play out. So I think as 23 rolls on, a lot of people have said recession, a lot of people have said soft landing. I think you guys both had talked about that in the intro. I don't think anyone knows. If we all knew the answer, we would, be acting accordingly. But, so far the jobs report came out last week are very strong, right? Unemployment remains very low. And so I think, with that in mind, there could be some more Fed rate increases, right? Which will just increase borrowing costs, which eventually will slow the economy down. It's just a matter of, when it happens and how severe.
Yeah, it's never the same way twice. I think of it kind of like as squeezing a balloon. We talked about real estate risk and debt. You squeeze that part and then the risk kind of just pops out somewhere else and the economy is in a different shape than it was before. You can't just dust off the econ book, like you're saying, and go, okay, what do I do when there's a pandemic and rising job growth? So,
and can you remember a time in history where they're almost trying to create a recession, right? Like the Fed is usually there to stimulate growth, right? take the interest rate down, take the savings rate down, so people actually use their capital, or you know, to use it to spend or to invest. We're going in the opposite directions. I don't think anyone really knows kind of how this is all going to shake out, but it's not, you know, it's not favorable, right? When you keep raising interest rates at this rate, it makes things less affordable. Asset prices will have to come down, and eventually companies are going to get hit by the interest costs, right? And can only pass through so much of that expense. So eventually you will see unemployment tick up at some point. We just don't know, I think, when that's going to happen.
Yeah, you can almost imagine Jay Powell going, strong jobs growth, damn it. I have to ratchet it up again. I mean, if we see inflation kind of level off, that seems to be the metric that he's really trying to avoid.
Yeah, I mean,
getting out of control. So
in theory, right, the interest rate has to match the rate of inflation, right, to stop it. So they still have a little bit more to go, right, on the interest rate side. So you know, I think you could definitely see some rate hikes coming here in the early part of 23. We'll see. As far as our business goes, you know, we're a credit access business. OppFi was created to provide people that didn't have traditional unsecured options from banks. Better options, fair products, you know, with amortization, with the ability to pay factored in, verification of income, and really kind of took aim at the payday loan, title loan, and pawn shop markets back in 2012. And, you know, today we partner with banks to expand credit access. What's really interesting is banks have a, you know, a $30 billion+ a year industry, revenue industry with NSF and overdraft fees. So a lot of consumers actually have bank accounts with big four banks, but they don't really lend to them, you know, beyond really just allowing them to overdraft and NSF. And if you look at those products, right, they're very detrimental to the customer. They don't really do anything for the customer. It's really just a fee-based way that banks can kind of make money off of people who overdraft or kind of, you know, have one-time expenses that go over the threshold. So, you know, we really decided, hey, like, we're going to go out and find a product that resonates with the customer, allows them to be successful, and actually try to stabilize their financial situation and repay over time and build their, hopefully, their credit profile back up with the bureaus by making on-time payments and reporting to those bureaus. And so actually what we saw was an unbelievable amount of demand in 22, because what happened was the banks tightened. Whenever there's volatility in the markets and uncertainty, banks immediately tighten unsecured credit. It's like almost like an instinctive reaction that happens. And then what happens is the next tier of lenders, which are, I guess, defined as non-prime, just below the banks, and that those businesses are like LendingClub, Upstart, OneMain, Avant, they tighten. And so what actually happens is some of the borrowers that they're not lending to anymore now become our borrowers, right? And it actually is beneficial for us. And so we've seen that actually help us for new originations and with our bank partners. And actually been able to provide more credit access and seen a significant amount of those borrowers kind of coming into our offering. The one thing though is on our end, when you have shock inflation, our customers, you know, I think you guys have seen the stats. There's a large swath of customers that, you know, have about a month of reserves when it comes to unexpected expenses or emergency expenses. And so with costs being 9% higher for everyday goods and services, it definitely had impact on delinquencies. And I think, you know, it started down in kind of our segment and is now kind of working its way up into where you're starting to see some cracks in some of the mid-tier and even into the upper tier. I think low unemployment has kept this from getting, you know, really, really in the concern area. But we definitely saw some of this in the middle of the year when that the shock inflation kind of prolonged and people really had to adjust their lifestyles and their spending patterns. And we've seen a nice reversal. And I think that people have really adjusted their lifestyles, whether it's buying, you know, cheaper groceries, whether it's not eating out as much, but people really have adjusted their lifestyles to be able to accommodate these price increases. And I think the one saving grace, I keep saying this, is low unemployment though. Our customers have been gainfully employed and so kind of has everybody, and we've record low unemployments. numbers kind of still. So that is the saving grace here as far as credit goes.
Yeah, the other reversal from the beginning of COVID is credit card balances starting to go up. I saw it was about $3 billion a month in the past few months of a credit card balances going up. And then with Powell trying to push employment down, that's do you have to adjust your models a bit for this kind of a changing world?
I think the last stat I saw was like savings rates are still like 1.5 trillion. Like people have more 1.5 trillion more dollars in their savings or bank account, if you will, than they did kind of coming out of the pandemic, which is great. But like in terms of the economy, I think like they said that will last until like middle of next year, those savings. And then, you know, like you said, you're going to start to see unsecured credit being tapped more aggressively, and it all just, you know, we'll see if the financial institutions kind of allow for it, or they tighten, and then you can kind of have, you know, some issues there. But yeah, the amount of unsecured credit, I think, you know, is sitting in the 1.4 to 1.5 trillion, you know, which is approaching all-time highs again. And it's you know, it's something to be concerned of, especially if interest rates on these credit cards are floating rate, right? it can get very expensive for borrowers.
So you guys don't pull like a hard credit pull. You use other kinds of data. What other kind of data do you use, and how do you get access to it?
Yeah, so our customers, you know, whether it be that they don't have any credit history, or they've you know, when they were young, they maybe had a misstep in their credit or made a mistake, you know, we actually look at people's ability to pay and in verification of income. Like that's really important to us, right? We want to make sure someone's gainfully employed, they can afford our product. So that's number one. And number two is we're really looking at the ability to manage their finances through their bank account, and you know, to make sure that the person doesn't have a debt to, you know, income ratio that's unsustainable, right? And a lot of that is factored into our underwriting. I think like when you get into this 680 and above FICO score, and you know, a measure used by the bureaus, the three main bureaus, they kind of score people with a FICO score, for all the listeners out there that are not, you know, intimately involved or have knowledge of it, but essentially a 700 is a good score. So when you get above 700, it's very predictive, right? And you know, that really constitutes a pretty secure borrower. But I think when you start to get, you know, in the mid to low sixes, high fives of credit FICO band, you have to really verify these attributes, right? And then it becomes much more important. And so we have an alternative scoring model that incorporates those attributes and that data. And it also allows for more credit access. So like, for example, if a traditional lender just looked at the FICO score, they'd say, oh, I would never extend them credit because their credit score is too low. Well, we said, well, let's challenge that. Let's factor in all these different data attributes and see if this person actually is credit worthy, and that they just had a hiccup, or they had to file bankruptcy back in 08 when they took out a 105% LTV mortgage that they were giving out to people or something. You know, there's reasons, right? And so we kind of look through the reasons and give people a chance and really try to, you know, give them the opportunity to repay and be successful in our system. And then obviously report those payments to the bureau to show that they're credit worthy and that they report on time payments.
So on that note, Todd, I understand that a lot of the value property you have as Alphi is that you're able to essentially underwrite customers using better tools as well, right?
Yeah.
But it's more tech, it's more data inputs. As you say, what's sort of the secret sauce for this is the first part of the question. And the second part of the question is, what is stopping a traditional lender from actually using the tools that you have now? So how are you doing the business in a way that creates a moat around what you do that others cannot copy?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we one thing, you know, to factor in is also our customer service. We have an 82 NPS score currently. We've always maintained higher than an 80. So we service people in a very unique way.
Well, wait, what's an NPS score?
a net promoter score. So it's a survey of customers post transaction. And, you know, most financial institutions sit in the 55 range. 50 to 55 is probably good for a financial services institution. But, you know, we really, you know, I think it's a real score that shows the value creation that we're creating for our customers, right? Like, how do they value us and the product we're offering and the service that we're providing? And so NPS is something that we look at weekly as a customer sat metric, in addition to some other, you know, QA and quality sat metrics. But I think, so that's a really unique, right? The way we service our customers and the way we treat our customers with dignity and respect. I think on the underwriting side, though, we do have a lot of data, right? We were one of the first companies to actually take people's banking information and digitize it into our scoring model. That was no small feat that we kind of accomplished early on, call it 2015. This really allowed us to help, you know, scale our offering and provide more credit access. It's important, right? And it also, from an ethical standpoint, if somebody has negative balances in their bank account, like, it's really unethical to give them, you know, a loan that would just bring them back to zero or even plus 100, right? Like, that's not an ethical, that's something that you'd say, listen, come back to us when, you know, we don't want to exacerbate problems with people's credit. We want to really do the right thing and make sure it's actually helping someone get ahead, as opposed to just kind of, you know, getting them back to a level where they're just positive, right? So I think, like, we are an ethical lender. We fully federally and state compliant. And like I said, we've been able to incorporate factors that typically used to be done manually, right? So you used to, like, employment verification, all this stuff was done manually in stores when I started the business. Like, I think 70-80% of unsecured consumer loans kind of were being done in a storefront setting. So we reverse engineered the in-store experience kind of in the digital world. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, separates, as far as we don't, you know, we do have some offshore partners for some, like, overflow volume, but we primarily service everything in-house, vertically integrated. And I think it's the most expensive way to service a customer, but we think it's vital to our brand and vital to the experience of the customer, and something that we, you know, really value. So we choose to spend, you know, kind of our some of our overhead there to make sure our customers have great experiences.
You're a public company, though. Is there a lot of pressure on that kind of expenses or anything like that? Where
you have
to push back a little bit. I mean, in any part of your business model.
Yeah, I mean, listen, if we don't spend that, right, then we're just a low-rated online lender, right? That was never the goal. By the way, the goal of the company when I started it, out of a one room office, you know, with 50 grand by myself and was getting, like, referrals from this local pawn shop, was to really expand credit access and help people. I at that point I was like, this is going to probably not work. I don't even want to tell anyone about it, that I'm doing this. Like, I don't even think LinkedIn was a thing back in 12, or I guess it was started to be, but I didn't put it on LinkedIn. I wasn't advertising that I was doing this, cause I was pretty sure it wasn't going to work. And, you know, sure enough, slowly but surely, you know, we just built this up over time. And then eventually, obviously, the public thing happened last year, or 2021 in July. But it was never the goal, right? The goal was really just to provide credit access, provide a better product and solve a major problem. You know, our addressable market is between 15 to 18% of the US population. It's massive. It's like 45 to 60 million people that really lack traditional credit options, like, you know, from banks and tier one credit card providers.
So you have lots of room to expand in the market still. What are some of the challenges in you guys continuing to grow? What would you like to see get easier, or hurdles you'd want to overcome?
Yeah, one of the things that we have is something that we're really working on is educating regulators and politicians to really understand why we exist in our offering and understand credit access. I think there is this narrative by some, you know, all lending's bad lending, right? All financial services companies are bad. And I think, like, that's not the reality, right? The reality is, like, there are partners, like, you know, we partner with banks, but there are service providers, financial service providers out there that are good and are doing good. and provide a real service and a real benefit to our customers. And I think like we need to do a better job of educating policymakers, politicians, and regulators about the true value of credit access and some of the challenges in some of the states that don't allow for small dollar lending. We find that what they do is they cut off access to our population. And we have like, there was just a study that came out in Illinois about this, like the unintended consequences of when they do this, it's devastating to our customers. So like everything from foreclosure to repossessions of cars to they're going over state lines to get payday loans, inferior products, or taking out tribal loans, right? Like, which are like, you know, 7-8 times the cost and don't have any of the product features that we have. So, you know, I think sometimes when regulations get passed, it's a one size fits all approach, and they don't really actually listen to constituents that they need credit access. And we are all for consumer protections. Like we've even outlined bills that we would pass in states to like, you know, partner with the actual state government to be able to allow for credit access because we're that passionate and that serious about it. But I think that is one of the challenges, right? Making sure that policymakers, it's top of mind. Right now, there's so many things going on in the U.S. and there's so many things and there's so many media outlets talking about so many things that it's hard to get the attention, right? And place it. People know there's the credit access issue. Like you see an article almost once a month now that the average American only has 1 month of savings. 37% of Americans only have 1 month of savings, right? And living paycheck to paycheck, stuff like that. So they know it's out there, but making it top of mind in today's, you know, viral media kind of content, you know,
like, are you guys making TikToks?
maybe we should be. Maybe that's why we're not reaching
some reels.
We should definitely consider that. I'm probably not the most outward facing on the social media, but I think
how many influencers do you have?
Yeah, we need influencers and ways to get to more people to talk about credit access. Well, the one thing is financial service products are probably not the most fun thing to talk about. So we're gonna have to.
I've seen where there's some TikTok and a short form, like they explain economics. They got like Finfluencers, they explain like Jay Powell's speech in like a minute and a half, just very cut up and very short bites, but some complex issues that I thought it was kind of funny.
You know what they say, John and Steve, you learn something new every single day. A Finfluencer, that is a new one I have never heard of, and I'm gonna look into it. But that's really interesting.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. It's not just like a funny joke thing. I mean, it is interesting the way they chop up like Jay Powell's speech and then just kind of put in little explanations of what's going
they
on.
They make it palatable for today's generation, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's not just pumping crypto scams, right? It's actually providing some.
It's not. Although that's the other 99%.
That's the other, yeah.
But there is that 1% that are kind of like, interesting, adjusting the message that we all get, but into these new formats.
Yeah, digestible, right? I like it.
Exactly. Yeah. So Todd, are you direct to consumer now, or are you white labeling your stuff to banks, or what sort of the model that you have right now?
No, we're a service provider, technology service provider, vertically integrated that works with banks to provide unsecured. The banks make the loans. We're the service provider that helps power it, I guess you would say. But it's not a white label for the banks. We are our own brand and stand aside as a separate entity.
Interesting.
That's kind of our offering right now. We work with a couple different banks. That's not just one. So we have several bank partners. But yeah, that's we're really good at that, and we've really expanded on our offering and really been able to expand on geography. The different geographies and wish we could even help more, right? Like I said, we're somewhat limited in some states by some regulatory things, but I think we've kind of tried to help as many people as we can and expand access as much as we can.
Speaking of helping people, I know that you also have this process whereby if a customer applies for a loan with you, you actually will go out and search for a lower APR loan for them as well. And if somebody is officer, you actually will match them. If they don't, then you'll step in. Can you talk me through how that process works from an operational and a technology perspective?
Absolutely. And by the way, I'm surprised I haven't mentioned it. We're already 20 minutes in. It's probably one of the things I'm most proud of at OppFi. It's something that we launched a couple of years back. Really what it is it's like, you know, the internet's a large, vast place. And when someone really needs, you know, kind of an unsecured product to meet a need, what we say is like, hey, yeah, we're slightly more expensive. We're helping you rebuild and stabilize your financial health. Let's go check a consortium of trusted, qualified, lower cost lenders first to be sure that you can't get a lower rate first before you engage with us, right? Mm-hmm. And it's something that I think customers value. You know, the unfortunate part of it is like only 7% to 9% of our customers match. And we wish that would be a lot higher. And I think like, it's so funny, year by year, it changes. Some years it's higher, some years it's lower, depending on how like, by definition, like loose credit is above us. So in 2021, when credit was flowing pretty, you know, the match rates were pretty high, probably the highest we'd ever seen. And right now they're down in the 5% range. They're the lowest we've seen. So, you know, it ebbs and flows with really what starts at the top with the banks, right? When the banks tighten, kind of flows down through the financial system. But yeah, I'm really proud of that. A lot of customers have been able to didn't even realize they were eligible for lower cost of capital and have, you know, actually been able to get lower cost of capital, which is great. And then if we engage with someone, you know, our goal is always to graduate you so that you do get upmatched, down the road. So, but it's something that, you know, we've been doing, and I think it's a great product feature.
You also partnered with a company that I'm actually quite familiar with, a company called Spring 4. Can you tell us about how the partnership works and what benefit that derives for your customers?
Yeah. Well, we have a couple different, you know, product features in addition to Spring 4, you know, one being Experian Boost, right? So a customer, when they become a customer of ours, they can try to, you know, use Experian Boost, which is a tool that allows you to kind of have the credit bureau look at your credit and see if there's easy ways to kind of increase your score. I believe Spring 4 is a financial wellness partner that we use that can kind of help people and connect them with financial wellness. These are product features that we kind of add at no cost to our customers to really just help and improve you know, their lives. And that's really the goal kind of OppFi.
Interesting. And what are the kind of outcomes that you hope to drive with stuff like this? Is it to get folks to essentially stop using your service at some point, or to get more access to better unsecured loans or something? What's sort of the outcome that you hope this will
drive? Absolutely. Like, our goal is to graduate them, right? So it's actually to lose a customer, which we're okay with. That means we did our job. That's why we exist, right? So what we did is we stabilized their financial situation with a financial product. They repaid it responsibly. Their credit profile improved. And they use some of the tools like Experian Boost, some of the other tools we provide to our customers to be able to qualify for lower rates and kind of change the outcomes of our borrowers. That is the goal. You know, people say, well, if you lose all your customers, what happens? I mean, the unfortunate reality of kind of just recessions and what goes on is, you know, there's people graduating, but then there's probably also people that, you know, are hitting, you know, having a misstep or maybe lost their job or something's going on in their life, right? Which maybe brings them to a situation where we need to help them. So it's kind of like a little circular thing there, but I think the goal is to graduate customers 100% and send them off on their way to hopefully lower cost of capital and better financial options.
Interesting. So, and I know that also from a corporate side, you went public via SPAC, I believe, in 2020 as well. How is that experience in terms of how you run your business now? And would you do it differently if you could?
Well, I mean, you know, it was a very unique time, right? Where valuations were definitely very favorable. And, you know, the company had a situation where a blank check company, FG&A, came to us. And, you know, I think it was at the time the right call. And I don't think we would change that. I mean, the deal that, you know, we did with FG&A and the partnership was something that, you know, you would probably do again. I think what was unexpected, though, was what was going to happen in 2022 shortly after, with interest rates doubling and kind of the credit, you know, issues and kind of some of the aftermath. Right. The other thing is like, we get caught up in like SPAC mergers become a dirty word on Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And our company, you know, is profitable, right? And growing at, you know, 20-30% a year, and is a standout in the SPAC merger. You know, and it's, it, there's a lot of SPACs. Like, the day that we announced our SPAC, listen to this, a flying taxi company announced a SPAC merger the same day. So like that's the type of lunacy and craziness that was going on. And like a lot of these bank check companies and SPAC mergers, the ones that got done, are all on the other side and probably not going to make it, right? Which basically just sets up a cycle of private equity firms just taking these private again, right? Which is going to happen. Like, I think once we get on the other side of this recession, there's some more confidence in like what interest rates will look like. I think you're going to start to see where all these companies went public in 21 and early 22 are now going to start going private again. It's going to reverse, right? It's kind of like this cycle where private equity firms will start taking out these companies that probably shouldn't be. They really are better geared in the private markets, right? Companies that are not profitable, that are growing, are definitely probably better as private businesses than public ones. So I think like what our job is as a public business right now is to really differentiate ourselves and get away from like, hey, we're not like every other SPAC merger or every other fintech deal that, you know, isn't doing necessarily that great. We have a real sustainable business model, and we've been around for, you know, 10 plus years now. And we've been doing this, you know, we've helped well over a million customers. You know, we've originated billions of dollars of loans. And so, you know, we're not like something that was just taking advantage of the situation and going public. Like, we have built this thing the right way over the last 10 years and you know, gotten there a little differently than a lot of these other companies.
Excellent. So that's basically looking back, right, at the work that you've done. What do you think is the future for AppFi, say 5 or 10 years from now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, number one is our core business of providing credit access to consumers. Is there's a lot of growth there. You know, we're growing, you know, 25% this year. You know, that's what we've publicly guided towards. I think there's a lot of growth, right? We can keep making our product better, right? Finding better ways to service our customers, continuing to maybe access more geographies and continuing to help more people. So that's number one, first and foremost. I think like there's really interesting opportunities. You know, we've been looking into credit repair, debt consolidation. I think like you have this wall of unsecured debt. I think we talked about it at the beginning of the show, where like it's going to be hitting record high soon, where customers are going to be saddled. And if you start to see unemployment spike, you know, I think there's going to be more unsecured debt that is delinquent, and people are going to need these kind of like high quality consolidation and credit repair firms there to be able to help them sort through. Obviously, filing bankruptcy is the most punitive thing a consumer can do for their credit score, and it really damages your ability to get credit on the other side. And so like, if people can find ways to work out their debts and close them out without having to file bankruptcy, it's very beneficial for the consumer, right? And allows them to kind of stay in the game and still get access, right? Because that's a great behavior. If someone had kind of a lot of past due unsecured debt and resolved it, you know, by working it out with the lenders and put their best foot forward, I think that behavior is rewarded, right, by lenders and finance companies. So I think there's some opportunity there, right, for us, and it's very synergistic for our business in general. We're also looking at small business lending. So small business lending is something that is, yes, it's to a business, not a consumer, but the same kind of macroeconomic backdrop is there, right? Like, for small working capital loans for small business, banks just like consumers, right? Like they don't really enter the space. It's probably just too fragmented and too small for them. Banks are focused on larger loans, whether it's SBA loans or, you know, larger loans to more established businesses where they can allocate more dollars of principal. But in this working capital space for small business, there's probably 5 to 10 million small businesses out there that lack traditional credit access options for working capital to help them grow and run their businesses. I think there's something to look at there, and there's some real opportunity for OppFi. So, you know, we're a credit access business, right? That's why I say credit access is not for just for consumers, right? If there's an opportunity to help Main Street and small business in America, we're going to look at it. And it could be something that OppFi, you know, enters into in the next couple of years.
Yeah, really interesting. A lot to dig into there. But I wanted to ask you what you thought, or what you think the impact of buy now, pay later has been on consumers, and where you see that going.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, I just don't really, the business model is really, really, you know, one of the business models that, you know, I look at a lot of these. The reason I don't love buy now, pay later, this is just my personal opinion, so I want to state that up front, is, you know, it's a business model predicated on people who don't, after four payments, who enter into a financing arrangement are kind of like the people who have the worst behaviors are the ones that these companies make all their money off of, right? Mm. And so, like, by definition, like, your good customers, you're not making any money off of, and all the customers that are exerting kind of the wrong behavior, which is like not paying it off in the free time period of the first four payments or five, whatever it is, number of payments. So, looking at that, like, I don't fully understand that kind of model. Like, our business is like, when our customers are successful, those are the ones that reward us, right? And the ones that pay us back and the ones that exert great behaviors are the ones that kind of reward us financially. I wonder, you know, why people are using it. Does it overextend people? I'm not sure. Right. I just don't know yet. And I think that, like, it's kind of been something that has grown really quickly and seems popular with consumers. But I think that it's probably something that's going to be looked at pretty closely by the CFPB and some of the regulatory bodies to make sure that it's not harming customers in any way. And it's not, you know, causing worse outcomes for them by kind of paying over time versus being able to afford it when they actually purchase it.
Yeah. And as we head into a recession, we might see if some of that credit access ends up coming back to bite, maybe, right. Which is a lot of the concern in the press and
right.
What we've been seeing. But another tool that's helps people that don't have a lot of savings, so, you know, the flat tire happens and the short on rent is earned wage access, getting access to your paycheck a little bit early. Do you see that as just another tool in the toolkit for people that don't have a lot of savings maybe negative?
Well, I've heard a couple different variations of that. I think there's one where you get paid 2 days early. I mean, in reality, like, getting paid 2 days early definitely helps, but I'm not sure that solves the problem. I think there are some smaller programs where they'll actually let you, like, draw on a future month's earnings, you know, and at a palatable interest rate or fee or nominal fee. I think absolutely those help, right? I think that definitely helps the consumer. I'm very, you know, if it's done in an above board ethical way, it's compliant, I think it makes a lot of sense, right? A lot of these issues that people run into are cash flow issues, right? They have an income, they have a job, but the timing of when they receive their cash flows is the issue. So anything that can reduce that, right, for customers, where it's just a matter of them getting the money that they've probably already earned, because a lot of these paychecks get paid in arrears, would allow for better financial health for the consumer. So I'm all for it, especially if you know, customers value the service.
You mentioned going into the small business and addressing that the underserved part of that market as well. We've seen a lot of fintechs go into the SMB market. Anything interesting that you see in there, or the main gap you'd like to fill that that maybe they a lot of these fintechs haven't addressed?
Yeah, I think in the small business space, there's some doing it well. I think it's a highly fragmented, large, you know, addressable market. So there's room for other entrants. But I think where I've seen companies go wrong is where they've tried to be a small business lender for everybody, right? and solve like the whole problem. And listen, when you're underwriting a $10,000 working capital loan versus a $100,000 loan, like those are not the same borrowers. They're not the same customers.
That's funny you say that. What Brex just pulled out of that smaller market to kind of focus on.
Yeah,
on their
and
core.
So that's what OppFi did. I always say WD-40, right? You know, the product WD-40 one thing and it does it really well. that's kind of what I think when you create a business. Like, we're going to go after a very, very like specific segment and a specific issue within small business. Small business is vast and large, right? And you have different flavors, different use cases. You know, I see these lenders that have loans from $5,000 to $2.5 million. It's like, how are you underwriting a $5,000 loan versus $2.5, you know, and how can you build a portfolio construction around that, right?
Yeah, you can't be awesome at both.
And so like, I think a lot of that's been kind of like, hey, we want to have something for everybody, because I think in the small business space, acquisition is harder to come by than consumer. So I think like, that's why they do it. They say, hey, like if we get a lead, we want to be able to service them up and down. But the reality is like doing that well and underwriting that effectively is very difficult, right? So I think you just got to be really good and know your space and know where you play and kind of just dominate in that thing. And that's really what OppFi did, right? Like we know that there's lenders, you know, above us, there's Upstart, OneMain, and, you know, we technically could go into that space, but we're like, hey, there's a lot of lenders, there's a lot of competition in that space. We want to be the best lender or best service provider in our space. And we want to own that and win that space, right? And have that kind of moat around us. So you just have to know your lane and know, you know, where you want to build and what problem you're solving.
You know, I was going to ask you what advice you might have for any other fintechs out there, but I think that was it.
Stay in your lane. Yeah. Stay in your lane.
Do something well.
Just do one thing and do it really, really well. And the other thing I'll say is like, you don't go into like a one room office on the north side of Chicago with $50,000, like, you know, and start a business like I did, which, you know, a lot of people told me wouldn't work. And unless you have immense passion for what you're doing. So like, listen, we all like economic gain or monetary gain, of course, but you can't start with like, I want to start this business to make a lot of money. If you have that like in your heart of hearts, like that's the reason, it's just all about
that's
money.
Not why you start a podcast either, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Because you have to get up every single day and you have to show up and you have to grind it out, you know, 14 hour days the first couple of years. And you literally can't do it. We're not paying myself. You know, you really just can't do it unless you have like passion to solve a problem. And that's what drove me, right? Every single day was like, I want to solve this problem and I want to make the world a better place for this, you know, this issue. So that's really, you know, where my drive and real passion comes for credit access and helping people, and knowing that every day, you know, we interact with thousands and thousands of borrowers and hopefully help their financial situations. It makes me feel good.
Yeah. Wow. It sounds like you definitely picked the right business for yourself there. That's something you obviously are passionate about. You know, I've had founders say two different things about when they're first starting out. One of them is don't tell anybody, because they're just going to tell you, you know, what are you going into lending for? You know, Bank of America and all these other people are doing that. How are you going to compete against them? And I remember, I think that was the Sarah Blakely, the Spanx one. She was like, yeah, people were telling her, you know, you're crazy. There's all these big companies doing that. So you might get that and that might discourage you. And then other founders who say, yeah, get it out there and you get ideas and connections. And like the guys who founded Bombas, these socks, had this fantastic connection and to manufacture what they wanted to do. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, I call it the fast casual hamburger, right? Like there's 15 of these things, right, in Chicago, right? But like, you know, the ones that are doing it really well are doing well. So it's highly saturated, you know, many tried, a lot have come along, but like, there's always room for a very good product that drives value to a consumer, right? No matter how many times it's been tried, right? There's a lot of examples of that, right? Like, you know, there was consumer lenders, I'm sure, before OppFi. There's been, but if you do something and you find kind of a niche and you do it really, really well, back to my passion and doing one thing really well and provide value to a customer, I think you're going to do well. It really doesn't matter how many else, you know, others are out there. If you're doing it your way and you really believe in it, I think you'll see success.
Well, it's great that you're seeing so much passion for helping other people and people who are, you know, have poor credit scores, have had some tough breaks here and there. We definitely wish you all the luck going forward and all the best to OppFi.
Thank you. And wish you guys continued success on your podcast and, you know, hope you guys continue to create, you know, great content for your listeners. And it was an honor to be on the show. So thank you for having me and good luck to you.
Yeah. Thank you. That's Todd Schwartz, the founder and CEO of OppFi. Please subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news. And thank you for listening.